Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Stagecraft is brought to you by the Geffen Playhouse. Now on stage and extended until December 17th, Tyne Daly shines in Chasing Memories, a different kind of musical. With songs written by legendary lyricists Alan and Marilyn Bergman, Tyne Daly stars as a woman not quite ready to let go of the life she's loved and the love of her life. Norman Lear declares it a touching, luscious, triumphant piece of theater, and Broadway.com exclaims it's a complete joy to watch. Don't wait. Visit geffenplayhouse.org for tickets. You're listening to Stagecraft, Variety's theater podcast, bringing you in-depth interviews with the creators and stars of the hottest shows on Broadway, off-Broadway, in London, and around the country. I'm your host, Variety's theater editor, Gordon Cox. Are you ready, kids? SpongeBob SquarePants has hit Broadway. A new musical based on Nickelodeon's long-running animated series is currently in previews with an entirely original storyline and a score by a head-turning and widely disparate list of songwriters that includes John Legend, T.I., Panic at the Disco, and the late David Bowie. After a run in Chicago in 2016, the musical opens at the Palace Theater December 4th. We have four of the show's creators and stars here in the studio to tell us all about bringing SpongeBob from screen to stage, starting with director Tina Landau, known for shows including Floyd Collins and Superior Donuts, and the writer Kyle Jarrow, who wrote the script for the 2003 Downtown Buzz Magnet, a very merry unauthorized children's Scientology pageant, and the creator of Valor, the new TV show on the CW. Tina and Kyle, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Tina, this project started with you, but you didn't know the show before you got involved. What prompted you to consider working on it, and how did you come up with your approach to it?
Yeah, well, I knew of the show. I mean, who doesn't know SpongeBob, of course. But, I got a call from my agent saying that Nickelodeon was interested in having directors come in to pitch ways of conceiving of putting SpongeBob on stage with...
Because it's a hard thing to get your head around, right? Like, how do you put SpongeBob on stage?
Impossible. And they weren't convinced they were going to do the show. They just wanted to know, is there a way to? And what would that look like? And when I first got the call, my agent said, are you interested? And I said, no. Really quickly.
I didn't know that, actually.
Oh, yeah. Cool. And he said, well, wait a minute. They're not interested in doing a theme park big mascot head costume thing.
Was that your first thought? They were like, they want a theme park and I don't want to do that?
Well, yeah. My first thought was, a big rubbery, poofy, foamy, yellow sponge costume on stage.
Right.
And I was like, no, not going there. Mm-hmm. And it turns out I haven't had to.
Right.
But my agent said, well, hold on a minute. Steve Hillenburg, who's the creator of the show, comes from this background of experimental and animated film, and he's a marine biologist. And he said that, and he doesn't love Broadway musicals. And so he said he would allow the property to be considered as a Broadway musical if it had a, quote, indie spirit. And those were the magic words my agent said to me on the phone. I was like, oh, well, let me think about what that would mean. And, as soon as I freed myself from, my first kind of bad impression of what this could be and allowed myself to imagine alternate ways and different kinds of performance techniques that could be involved and different musical styles, I started creating in my head a kind of piece, a show, an event that would appeal to me. And I just followed along that, pitched those ideas, and was fortunate that they selected me to follow through on them.
And there was a very specific episode that was kind of your way in, as I understand it. Tell us about that.
Yes, it's Idiot Box, which is an early episode in which SpongeBob and Patrick receive a box with a TV in it. And, most people would throw out the box and keep the TV and watch TV. But they discover that they in fact want to throw out the TV and keep the box, because with only the box and their imagination they can create anything and go anywhere. And I thought, not only is that what theater traffics in most powerfully, but the texture of a cardboard box, now here we are, we're doing this big gloriously designed musical, but somewhere at the center of its DNA is the cardboard box. And in fact, we do have a bunch of cardboard boxes in it.
Right. And so you got the gig, and then you needed an original story, and then Kyle came aboard. Kyle, tell us about how you got involved.
Yeah, I mean, I had the great advantage of when I came aboard, I could see what Tina's vision of indie SpongeBob was. So I didn't have the moment of hesitation, because when I took the meeting, I instantly understood the aesthetic, which is great, because most projects, it doesn't work like that. So that was really inspiring to walk into something where the aesthetic was clear, the approach was clear, and then it was just about figuring out a story.
Was it clear when you joined that you needed an original story as opposed to basing it on one or multiple
that
episodes?
That was sort of the brief from moment one, certainly when I got involved. I don't know when you guys agreed on that. But
that was always from the get-go. It was always, you know, Nickelodeon was great because they said, if we are just going to repeat something that we've seen or done on TV or film, why do theater? Like,
And those episodes, we should say, are what, 11 minutes long?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it'd be very hard to expand them anyway.
Yeah,
if you
but even to. Even so, the interest was always, we are going to do this project if we can reawaken the brand in some new way, because there's no other reason to do it. So it was always original story.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, so the super fun challenge was, here's a universe of characters. Here's, you know, a catalog of hundreds of episodes, and here's an aesthetic that Tina's developed for the stage. What is a story that combines all those elements? The big thing that we knew from moment one is we needed real stakes and a real emotional core, because, you know, a two-hour musical, you know, you need to have that center in a way that you don't in an 11-minute cartoon. But we also wanted to keep the manic, surrealist, comic pacing of the 11-minute episode. So that we sort of approached it with that challenge, like, what kind of a story gives you both? And what we arrived at is a story that really is about this whole community. And what that allowed us to do is intercut from one character storyline to another character storyline, so the scenes can be short and have that manic comic energy, but all of those storylines can intercut and add up to create, you know, a big story, overarching story with a thrust.
And what is the story? Tell us.
So I like to describe it as Armageddon meets Our Town meets SpongeBob. Mm-hmm. What the story actually is you've got this community, Bikini Bottom, where all these characters live, and there's a volcano on the outskirts of town called Mount Humongous. And early in the show, the ground starts rumbling. Sandy the squirrel, who's a scientist, has a seismograph, of course, as all scientists obviously
naturally,
do. Right? And realizes, oh no, like, it's going to erupt, and it's going to erupt at sundown tomorrow, and when it does, this town is going to be obliterated. So what the show is about is how everyone reacts to that. You know, some people lose themselves in fear. Some people try to exploit the situation. Some people, led by SpongeBob, decide we have to try to save our town. Others say we got to just abandon our town. So it really ends up being a story about how a community deals with crisis, how they come together or not, how differences that don't feel like they matter before a crisis suddenly start seeming like they matter when they shouldn't. And ultimately, for us, I think the heart of the story is that where we get to by the end is that these characters all realize that what they need to do to deal with crisis is come together. That's actually how they will make it through. On the way there, a lot of hijinks, a lot of craziness, and a lot of manic surrealist comedy. So I think we figured out that balance.
This is a question for both of you. How do you think of the balance? Well, that wasn't a joke. That wasn't a punchline.
I don't know the way you said it was.
How do you think of the balance between kids and adults? Because SpongeBob has fans in all of all ages. And how did you think of sort of pitching the show toward that extremely broad demographic with a lot of different components?
You know, we never set out to make a quote-unquote children's show or children's theater. We always thought the kids are a built-in audience. And we want the broadest audience possible. And we kind of have layered in different things that we think will appeal to different generations.
That actually, you know, it has taken some work to calibrate, but we had a great example of how to make it work for seasons and seasons on television.
And, yes, right. Examples. And people who have created that show and written it. And, you know, we were
Did you talk to a lot of those people?
Yeah, well, they were so generous with their time.
We had a couple of trips to California to the studio where they were really just sharing sessions. They were, you know, brainstorming or us asking questions or seeing how they storyboarded. None of it was, what's that word, like prescriptive. Mm-hmm. They weren't telling us how to do anything, but it was just useful to be in that environment and hear how their brains work.
We haven't yet talked about the score, which is really unusual and includes a huge array of well-known names. Tell us about how did that idea come about, and then how do you get all those people on board to do it?
It was one of the very first ideas I had going into my very first pitch meeting that we previously talked about, because I had watched the show some in preparation, doing research, and realized, oh, there's a whole mashup of genres that occur on the show. So Sandy sings in a country western style, and SpongeBob fantasizes being a hard rocker at some point. So you get all that on the show, and then I listened to the soundtrack album for the first film, and I loved the songs that the Flaming Lips wrote, and Ween and Weezer and Wilco, and I thought, that's what I want to hear in the theater. And this is a property that invites discongruity and juxtaposition. Yes, the world needs to be orally cohesive, but within that, it asks for, it begs for a clash of genre and style, and that's what makes it fun and SpongeBobian.
Kyle, for you as a writer, how does the way these actors embody these characters kind of influence what you've ended up with on the page?
You know, when we went out to L.A. to talk to the animators, I remember seeing the way that they write the show, which is that they storyboard it visually first. So they do the visual gags, the physicality of it first, and then they write the dialogue. And, you know, I thought to myself, like, wow, how can we bring, is there a way to bring at least a semblance of that process to the theater? And that's a little bit what we did, because I hadn't written a word when we had this physical workshop. So I just observed, and then sort of as the process has gone on, have observed and have tried to integrate physicality, you know, physical bits that they work out in the workshop setting, get integrated into the script. And I've tried to keep that, I think we both have, tried to keep that sort of organic process where it never becomes too verbal. It never leaves behind the physicality of the performances. And also, you know, with writing, I think a lot of it is you just absorb stuff. And then when you sit down in front of your computer, that's in your head. And so honestly, when I was writing the script, I was seeing Ethan as SpongeBob.
Right.
Can I just point out that you just said absorb stuff?
Oh,
yeah, he's absorbent.
But nice, you know, wonderful to be able to see Danny as Patrick and Ethan as SpongeBob when writing and imagine their physicality, know how they embody the characters. Again, a great privilege that most writers don't get on most projects.
And what did you learn from the Chicago production, and what do you bring with you from that into this new Broadway version?
Man, so many things.
You know, I'll let you talk about story. You know, I was fortunate in that I stayed in Chicago the whole run and just kept going back and ended up with this tome of things that I thought could be better. You know, I knew could be. And a lot of that came from watching the show. A lot of it came from listening to audiences in that kind of old George Abbott way of stand in the back and where do they laugh and where do they seem restless. And, you know, so my hit list coming back was very large, both in terms of story things that Kyle can say, but also upping the design. We changed order of some songs. We really kind of enhanced a number of the production numbers in Act One.
Upping the homemade quality of the design? It's a very sort of homemade aesthetic for being a big, fancy Broadway musical.
Yes, I'd say we upped homemade, but also kind of the invention of how things occur. We really tried to focus on that was okay, but was it really surprising? Did it really take that object and turn it on its head in the right way? And we just looked at every moment that way. Story-wise...
Yeah, I mean, story-wise, I'd say sort of three big areas. One is structure. We did a lot of restructuring, particularly in the first act. You know, the beginning of any story is really important, and how quickly we get into the main story of this volcano. Frankly, we just wanted to get into it faster. And so that was a big change. There were a couple of storylines that were kind of tertiary storylines in Chicago that we realized were great, really popped. And we just wanted to give a little more meat to them. So that was a big piece of it.
Like what?
You know, one in particular is there's a father-daughter relationship, Pearl Krabs and her father, Eugene Krabs. And, it was there in Chicago, but we hadn't dug super deep. They had one great song, and the audience just went nuts at that song every night. It's this song where he's singing about how much he loves money, she's singing about how much she loves this rock band, and we really see this father-daughter who cannot communicate. They don't hear each other. And we realized that's such a universal story and sort of touching and sweet. So that was a story we really bolstered. But I would say that the biggest two changes that we've made are we've made it funnier, or at least we've tried. I think we have.
Yeah.
And we've also made it deeper.
And like I said, we, in addition to those things, there are more kind of wow moments within songs. And also, we've also upped the power of Plankton as villain. Because, you know,
need a good antagonist.
Yeah, and we realized, yes, he was...
The name of the character is Plankton, by the way, for people who maybe are not familiar.
Yes, the name of the character, his full name is Sheldon J. Plankton.
I did not know that.
And he's a one-celled organism.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Well, I can't wait to see it.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Thanks
thank
for being
you.
Here.
It's been
and,
our pleasure.
We'll see you soon.
Cool.
Thanks. Awesome. Thanks.
That was director Tina Landau and writer Kyle Jarrow talking about the Broadway debut of the upbeat invertebrate SpongeBob SquarePants. Next up, we have SpongeBob himself, Ethan Slater, and Lily Cooper, who plays the scuba-diving squirrel scientist, Sandy Cheeks. Stagecraft is brought to you by the Geffen Playhouse. Now on stage and extended until December 17th, Tyne Daly shines in Chasing Memories, a different kind of musical. With songs written by legendary lyricists Alan and Marilyn Bergman, Tyne Daly stars as a woman not quite ready to let go of the life she's loved and the love of her life. Norman Lear declares it a touching, luscious, triumphant piece of theater, and Broadway.com exclaims it's a complete joy to watch. Don't wait. Visit GeffenPlayhouse.org for tickets. Hi, Ethan and Lily. Thanks for being here.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
Ethan, you were one of the first actors to join the cast, and you've been with it ever since. Where were you when you first tried out? And tell us about that first workshop that you were involved in.
Yeah, I am lucky enough to have been one of the original Movement Lab members.
And that was like 5 years ago?
It was 5 years ago. Okay. It started in May of 2012. And I was actually at Vassar College at the time with Lily.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know that. Yeah. You went to college together.
We went to college together. Yeah. We were just a couple of years apart. And I had applied for an apprenticeship program to work at Shakespeare on the Sound over the summer. Mm-hmm. And for that application, you had to audition. So that audition led to an audition for their main stage show, which led to the casting director calling me and saying, we have something coming up. It's called the Untitled Tina Landau Project. We think you might be the right physical shape for it.
And there was no... It was the Untitled Tina Landau Project, right. Not the Untitled SpongeBob Square.
No,
so
the
you
Untitled
had no
Tina
idea
Landau
what that
Project,
was.
Okay. Right. The role was Bubble Burt.
Right.
the only thing that really tipped me off was that the sides were from an episode of SpongeBob. So I was like, that is a really familiar... scene. How many shows does the character Bubble Burt eat something that might explode when the sun sets? That seems like SpongeBob.
Right.
So I went in for the audition, and it was just a physical audition. I did the sides. I actually didn't try to do a SpongeBob voice, which was risky, but I think paid off. and then I did like a physical comedy routine where I was trying to put on a sweater, but it was rebelling against me. And then I did a dance to Billie Jean, but there was a bee that was trying to sting me the whole time.
And then for the workshop, itself, there was no script or anything.
No
there was,
script.
It was just a physical, you guys figuring stuff out.
Exactly. It was just, you know, how do we take these characters and without prosthetics, without foam figures, just as a human in, at the time, gray sweatpants and probably a gray shirt, because that's my uniform, just be up there and look like SpongeBob. So it was about squaring off the shoulders, and I figured out how to walk the walk, which is just sort of a hinge. And then, you know, figuring out how to embody it. So there was some text, but it wasn't a book. It was just a couple of scenes to play off of.
And from what I understand, you drew on, or I guess all of you as you were working on it, drew on Abbott and Costello and sort of physical comedians from history.
Totally. I mean, that's like the thing that it feels like this show is as much based on SpongeBob as it is on the classic physical comedy geniuses, you know, of the early 20th century, of Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton and these sight gags and these physical comedy routines. And actually, you know, now that I say that, it's like the animated show is also based on that, on the Laurel and Hardy and the Abbott and Costello and these pairings of comedians, the SpongeBob and Patrick.
Right. Yeah.
So, but, you know, I hope not to jump another question, but people always ask, like, how much SpongeBob do you watch? And I've probably watched every episode at this point.
Was that true before?
At least once.
I had seen at least half of the episodes before that.
Okay.
But there are a lot of episodes.
There's been on for almost 20 years.
It's been on for a long time.
Lily, you joined for the Chicago production last summer.
I did, yeah.
And what was your... How much of a SpongeBob watcher were you?
I was a pretty big fan. I mean, I grew up like prime SpongeBob era. I was born in the 90s, and I watched it as a kid and still do. I always say that I have about like 10 or 15 episodes on my DVR at any given time.
And is that true right now?
It's absolutely true.
Yeah.
You know, just in case I have a moment to do some work research and
sure.
say that I'm, you know, doing work at home. I was a big fan. I always doodled in class. I would always doodle SpongeBob characters and the pineapple and all that when I was like in junior high. So it was a big part of my life.
And then for you, how do you turn into a, you know, scuba diving squirrel? How does that?
Well, I think it's something that I'm quite literally still exploring and discovering. The thing that made it easier is that Sandy actually does walk on her hind legs, so I can walk like I do normally in everyday life. Instead of like scurrying up trees. But she is, I think what's exciting about this project is that we're bringing the human traits out of these characters. So we're sort of turning them into the human versions of them. And I'm finding my inner squirrel while, you know, exploring Lily Cooper's version of Sandy. So finding her physicality also has a lot to do with her voice and her...
You know, I was just going to ask about the voice, because obviously voice acting is a huge part of SpongeBob in any animated film. How do you think about approximating that voice or not approximating your voice? How did you find it?
Totally. So one of the defining features of Sandy's voice specifically is that she's from Texas. So she has a little Texas twang. She also has sort of like a pingy, high-pitched level to it. And I've explored that part register of my voice. And a very important thing that Tina, our director, really instills in us is that we're not trying to directly replicate the actors' voices who do it on the show, but just sort of discover the DNA of their characters and explore their voices through our own. So I try not to imitate exactly, because like we talk about, if we are just imitating, we won't be succeeding in any way. We need to embody them and put their voices in our voices and sort of combine the two. So I definitely have a Texas twang, and I definitely
can you
have
do a little of it right now?
Well, she's a karate chopping squirrel, and she has a more of a high pitched kind of twang to her. So that's
and Ethan
where
do SpongeBob.
It's just like a little bit. It's a subtle little thing. So you know, it's like it goes. It varies the range.
And the cool thing is we have range to it, you know? Like, we can get high up in here and when we're excited, but we can actually be really grounded and have real conversations, too.
Right. I think that's like a push and pull that we've been playing with throughout rehearsal and throughout the years of development, is where we fully drop in. And, you know, if you ask Tina, that's one of the seems to be one of the most important things about the show is dropping into that character and finding the grounded center of it.
You've both kind of talked about this a little bit, in terms of finding kind of archetypal characteristics or like getting to the heart of them. What for each of you is the heart that has nothing to do with, you know, being a squirrel and being a sponge?
Yeah. Well, one of mine and my characters that's really prominent in the story that we're telling is that Sandy is a land mammal, and she's in this place where she is truly the alien to everyone else, and she's not like anyone else. Mm. So she's an outsider, and not everybody really understands where she's from and who she is. So that is an archetypal characteristic that I think people can relate to in especially our present day society. And so I think that's one of the strongest forces that she's dealing with in the story of our show.
And Ethan, what's essential SpongeBob for you?
Essential SpongeBob is his optimism and how he sees the world, and he sees the world as this beautiful place that could always be as best as it's ever been.
And you both did it in Chicago. What was that experience like in terms of the audience reaction? And you must have talked to a fair number of SpongeBob fans who have seen the show. What, how tough of a sell did you find it to say, I'm a sponge and I'm a squirrel?
Yeah.
It was an amazing experience doing it in Chicago for a number of reasons.
Totally.
But one of the amazing things about it was that we got to interact with fans, Broadway fans and SpongeBob fans alike. And for all of them, it seems, it was an easy sell. You know, as soon as we arrived on stage and said our lines and, you know, we're not wearing you know, the costumes we're wearing, our own
costumes. We should sort of describe, you're wearing basically a tie and a sweater, right,
Yeah,
Ethan?
Well, in Chicago, I was wearing a tie and a sweater vest.
Right,
it's going to be a little bit different on Broadway, but it's still sort of that sleek.
You've got the little shorts, too.
Square pants.
And you're wearing the helmet.
In order for Sandy to breathe underwater, she's in an astronaut helmet, but on stage, you know, it's sort of hard to do that because you wouldn't really be able to hear anything that I say. So what I love about the design is that we keep her silhouette. So instead of an astronaut helmet, she has an afro, and she still has the iconic flower on her afro and a white jumpsuit. So it's very astronaut costume-esque.
Tina talks a lot about the casting process of this and like needing to see the essential quality of the character and also see the silhouette. And like, that was really important to her. And so for me, you know, I'm sort of square. I'm short, for those who can't see me. And I've got wide shoulders. So it only takes a little bit of maneuvering for me to make myself look a lot more square. Danny is, you know, tall and he's a big guy. And Lily is like tall and athletic. And so like, next to each other, we fit the silhouettes. But more than that, I think, and not to, you know, speak of myself, but I feel like we like sort of embody the characteristics of these characters innately.
Absolutely.
And there's like, there's something in all of us that is immediately these characters. And so the fans in Chicago like felt that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had a lot of people who came up to us and they were like, you know, we were unsure, like we sort of were going to see this and we weren't sure whether we were going to like it, like, ah. And then, you know, 5 minutes in, they bought it. And I think
that's seconds in even.
Well, New York is going to get a chance to see it. You guys start preview. You're in the middle of tech. This isn't going to air for a couple weeks, but you're in the middle of tech right now. So they're about to go into preview. So break a leg next
week. Thank you so much. It's exciting.
It opens December 4th at the Palace. Thanks, guys.
Come check it out.
Yeah.
Thank you, Gordon.
Thanks.
Thank you.
That was Ethan Slater and Lily Cooper, two of the stars of SpongeBob SquarePants, now playing on Broadway at the Palace Theater. That's all for this episode of Stagecraft, but be here next time when I talk to director Julie Taymor and playwright David Henry Wong about their new production of M. Butterfly. Until then, see you at the theater. Stagecraft is brought to you by the Geffen Playhouse. Now on stage and extended until December 17th, Tyne Daly shines in Chasing Memories, a different kind of musical. With songs written by legendary lyricists Alan and Marilyn Bergman, Tyne Daly stars as a woman not quite ready to let go of the life she's loved and the love of her life.
Norman Lear declares it a touching, luscious, triumphant piece of theater, and Broadway.com exclaims, it's a complete joy to watch. Don't wait. Visit GeffenPlayhouse.org for tickets.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.